Omer Bartov, thank you so much for joining us on Upfront.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you, of course, are a leading scholar of the Holocaust and genocide. In your July 2025 New York Times piece, which was called "I Am a Genocide Scholar, I Know It When I See It," you described what's happening in Gaza as a genocide. This was not a small thing. The International Association of Genocide Scholars also recently reached the same conclusion in a very public statement. Many people had used it before individually, but this was the first moment where, as an aggregate, they said, hey, this is a genocide. Why has this conclusion been reached now and not 6 months ago, not a year ago, not 2 years ago?
Well, I can't talk about the International Organization of Genocide Scholars. I actually wrote already in August of 2024 in The Guardian that I'd reached the conclusion that this was a genocidal operation. But because the New York Times has greater reach, the article in mid-July this year caught more attention.
Let me pause you there, though, because there's something I remember reading that article and saying that this feels like a genocidal operation, or saying that they had genocidal intent, which was the language I think you used, still felt different than saying this is a genocide. It felt like you were making a distinction there.
Well, I talked about a genocidal operation, that's true. And here I said this is genocide, so there may be a little bit of a nuance, partly because there's been so much more information between last spring and summer of 2024 and right now. But I actually reached that conclusion in May of 2024, and that had to do with a particular event. That had to do with the IDF moving into Rafah in early May 2024, where there were a million people, half of the population of Gaza was in Rafah, and the IDF wanted to move in. And it, so it removed them again into Al-Mawasi, into the beach area, where there was no infrastructure whatsoever, and then proceeded to destroy Rafah. And it was at that point that I concluded the following, that there were two types of statements by Israel immediately after October 7th. There were a series of statements that I wrote about already in November of 2023 in the New York Times, which had the genocidal content, which spoke about we will flatten Gaza, they'll have no water, they'll have no food, they're human animals, and they will be treated as such. These were statements made by Netanyahu, by the then defense minister Gallant, and many others. But you could have said at the time that they might have been made in the heat of the moment, they were irresponsible statements. And then Israel also said what its war goals were. And it said the war goals are to destroy Hamas and to release the hostages. And it appeared relatively reasonable as a war goal. But by May, it appeared that that's not what the IDF was doing. It was not trying to release the hostages. It was not trying to destroy Hamas, which it failed to do, of course. It was trying to systematically destroy Gaza to make it uninhabitable for its population, to move the population to the south as much as it could, and to prepare that for ethnic cleansing. That is to simply remove, expel the population entirely from Gaza. And the problem is that there's no place for them to go to, which is how it becomes genocidal.
What are the stakes here in using the term genocide or genocidal? Irrespective of how we label it, the deaths are there, the destruction is there, the human rights abuses are there. But it seems to be a lot of contention about whether or not to use the word genocide. What are the stakes attached to that choice?
Look, first of all, when you say that a genocide is happening, you should, at least in my view, relate that to the Genocide Convention of 1948. That's the only definition of genocide. Everybody can have their own definition of genocide, whatever they like, but the only one that matters under international law is the one from the Convention of 1948. Now, most states in the world, including Israel or European states and the United States, are signatories to that definition, to that convention. And that convention says that signatory states, if they identify genocide, they need to prevent it and to punish. It's called, right? It's called a Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. So it's incumbent upon states, if they say that this is genocide, to act.
I see.
So that's very important.
As opposed to other human rights abuses or violations of international law.
Well, I mean, obviously, if you are a signatory to the Rome Statute of 1998, you should also act if you see crimes against humanity or you see war crimes. But there's no convention. It's not a UN convention. The US is not part of the Rome Statute, and Israel is not part of the Rome Statute. But the Genocide Convention is, and it's a unique kind of law because it also allows you to intervene in the affairs of a sovereign state. If a sovereign state is killing its own citizens in a genocidal manner, and you recognize it as such, you are not only allowed, but it's incumbent upon you as a signatory to do something about it and eventually to punish those who did it. So for that reason, when you say it's genocide and you say genocide as defined in the Genocide Convention, that has actual meaning in international law, and international law is about relations between states.
Do you see any truth to the concern that some have that Palestinians declaring that they've been the victims of genocide did not produce an international outcry, that Palestinian scholars and Palestinian journalists saying this is a genocide did not produce that kind of response, and yet when Israeli organizations produce the claim, or when European organizations produce the claim, that we get a different kind of global outcry? Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, I think so, but you need to contextualize that a little bit. First of all, if Israeli organizations are saying that their own country is carrying out genocide, obviously that has different weight, or scholars who are Israeli who say that, because you're talking about your own country, not about the enemy. You're talking about the country that you belong to. So that has one. The other side, I would say, is, and that's the problem with using the term genocide, and that's why I want to always refer to the Genocide Convention, because the term genocide has often been used as an expression of outrage. You see something terrible happening, you say it must be genocide. But it does not have to be genocide. Terrible things are not always genocide. There's a particular definition of what that is. And in the case of Palestinians and of all this ongoing conflict, the term genocide has been used at times irresponsibly. And so I think that it's important to, first of all, pay attention and show clearly why one thinks this is indeed conforms to the definition of genocide.
Walk me through that definition. Of course, the term genocide was initially coined in 1944 by Polish lawyer Raphael Lemkin. It has since evolved. We get to 1948, it reaches a different kind of definition vis-a-vis the United Nations. And now in 2025, it also has a particular meaning to people formally and informally. What exactly is genocide and what makes it such?
So it's interesting that you mentioned Raphael Lemkin, who was a Polish-Jewish lawyer who already in the 1930s started saying that there was a crime that had no definition. He was living in Poland. Germany invaded Poland. He escaped from Poland. His entire family was murdered by the Nazis. He ended up in the United States, wrote a book about the Nazi occupation of Europe, and in that book, he coined the term genocide and gave a preliminary definition of it and struggled mightily to have it adopted by the UN and succeeded in 1948 in it being adopted. So what is important about that definition is that it's about groups and not about individuals. So genocide are acts carried out with the intent to destroy a group in whole or in part as such. And that group can be an ethnic group, a national group, a religious group,
Or racial group.
Yeah. And then there are some subsections that describe what has to happen. What are these acts? And one of them is killing members of the group. So obviously there has to be killing of members of the group. But there are other elements there. There is causing major harm to members of the group, both mental and physical, right? There is creating conditions that would make life impossible for that group. So you're not directly killing them. You're creating conditions that will lead to their death. There is also prevention of births in the group. And that can be, among other things, by depriving the group of food. So we know that in Gaza, there's been a rise of 300% in miscarriages since October 7th.
Wow.
That every fifth child is born either prematurely or underweight, and they can't be fed by mothers who don't receive enough food, and there's no hospitals to take care of them. So you can, Gaza now is the world's center. It has the highest proportion of mutilated children, of children who've lost limbs in the world per capita. So you're talking here about both prevention of births, and I'm not talking, of course, about the conditions we know already have been created that make it impossible for that group to live there, but also even in the terms of prevention of birth, there has been massive harm to children who are half of the population of Gaza, under 18, massive mental damage to them, massive physical damage, even if they survive, because of the deprivation of food. By now, all the evidence is out there that this has been an attempt to destroy the Palestinians in Gaza as a group, and to make it impossible for them to reconstitute themselves as a group, not least by destroying also their schools, their universities, their mosques, their museums, their archives. So even if somehow they can return to the ruins of what were once their homes, everything that makes for a collective identity has been destroyed.
I want to talk about your own sort of personal experience. You served in the Israeli army and spent time in Gaza and the West Bank in the 1970s. You spoke about witnessing firsthand the poverty and the hopelessness of Palestinian refugees who were trying to make a living in, frankly, decrepit surroundings. You once recalled patrolling the streets in the Egyptian town of Arish, which was then under Israeli occupation. And you said that as you saw the way that people looked at you, you finally understood what it meant to occupy another people. Can you share more about that experience and also how it potentially shapes how you see what's going on in Gaza today?
Yeah, look, I mean, I was very young at the time. Right. I was about 20. I served in the West Bank for a pretty long time, for over a year. And I served for about half a year, I think, in Gaza and in Northern Sinai. And I can't say that at the time, as a very young man, I could think through all those things. It was more sensation than a clearly articulated understanding. But I do remember a particular day of patrolling in Arish, and sort of late morning, sunny, hot. Nobody was on the street. So I couldn't see people. What I knew was that they were behind their windows, the shuttered windows. And we were out in the sun, and we were walking down the street. And I have this very clear recollection. We were scared, of course, because we didn't know who is looking at us. The population was obviously scared because we were a bunch of armed people walking down the street. And there was no communication between us. And I felt, I was trying to understand, what am I doing here? Why am I here? What is the point of this? Now, I should say that even when I was in high school, before I was conscripted, so when I was 17 or so, this is only a few years after Israel occupied the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, right? And I remember participating in a number of demonstrations, very small demonstrations by high school kids, saying, occupation corrupts. This was our slogan, occupation corrupts. A kibush mashrit. I remember that very well. Occupation corrupt. We didn't quite know, and I don't know where we got that term from. But if you think about it from then to now, that is what the occupation did. It corrupted Israeli society. It became a completely different society. The army that I served in then, and armies are never nice organizations and they are trained to do bad things. But the army that I served in then and the army that Israel has now are totally different things.
How so?
Well, there are many differences. First of all, the composition of the army is very difficult, very different. The army then, and especially the combat units, that I served in were made mostly of secular, young secular Jews. And with some idea, as we were educated, of belief in justice and human rights, we actually believed in what we called Torah Neshek, the purity of arms. This was a term that was used. Now, it doesn't mean it was often honored in the breach, but it was there. We actually believed that we were doing something just and that we had to behave justly. The army that you have now, large parts of it by now, including generals, brigade commanders and so forth, are recruited in large part from the West Bank, from the settlers. They have a very, very different view of things. You can see now paratroopers, Israeli paratroopers, they look more or less the way they did when I was in the army, but they wear yarmulkes. They have these prayer shawls sticking out of their uniform. They have been socialized to think completely differently about what they're doing. There has been a tremendous growth in racism toward Palestinians.
In a previous interview, you said that the destruction in Gaza is actually greater than the destruction of Hiroshima, Japan, by nuclear weapons during World War II. Can you talk about what you mean here? Because that's a pretty provocative statement.
Well, I mean, if you look at what happened in northern Gaza, in Jabalia, if you look at what happened in Rafah, the amount of destruction in Gaza to the extent that well over 70% of all the buildings in Gaza have been either totally destroyed or partially destroyed, 90% of homes, 90% of schools. So in Rafah, for instance, there's nothing.
Yeah.
It's just one big pile of
rubble.
In Shujaia, there's nothing. Most of what the IDF is engaged in right now is demolition. It's not much fighting going on. I mean, the Hamas is a fighting organization. It has guerrilla groups. But it's a guerrilla warfare. It's not an organized military. What the IDF is doing is an intentional, a deliberate destruction of the place so that people would not be able to live there.
The UN-backed Global Hunger Monitor, the IPC, confirmed that a human-made famine had taken hold in Gaza City and nearby areas, warning that it could spread. Now, Israel has repeatedly imposed blockades and it continues to restrict humanitarian aid throughout the region. Israeli forces also opened fire on civilians at food distribution sites. This has been confirmed. What Doctors Without Borders has frankly referred to as orchestrated killing. Given these events, do you see this as a deliberate escalation in the tactics employed by the Israeli army?
Yes, of course. And again, I mean, you have to go back to the immediate aftermath of October 7th, when then Minister of Defense, Yoav Gallant, said they will have no food, they will have no water, they will have no power, they are human animals and they will be treated appropriately. He meant it. And so there were pressures on Israel, and sometimes there was a bit more food coming in, sometimes a bit less food coming in. But generally, the policy has been, and of course, both Gallant and Netanyahu have arrest warrants from the ICC, which, among other things, are about using starvation as a tool of war. So it was pronounced, and then it was implemented. Now, what has happened most recently with these with this Gaza humanitarian organization, which to me, I mean, just the use of the term humanitarian is part of the kind of euphemisms that are always used by organizations that are actually engaged in something totally different. Right. They use the term to mean something else. They've been called death traps. And they're not only intended to provide as little food as possible and to divert the world's attention from what is happening and to say we're actually providing food and we're not allowing Hamas to take it. It's only us distributing it. And the idea was, and Netanyahu was quite open about it, we've destroyed their homes. They're moving to the south to get food. And now they cannot go back. He said that in May. They cannot go back to their homes because we've destroyed them. Our only problem is to find states that will take them in. That's the policy. And it's openly stated, but often in Hebrew and not in English.
I want to delve into how the starvation in Gaza is viewed. There's a video from Israeli Channel 14 that showed TV hosts and commentators mocking Gazan children who were starving. They even went so far as to claim that the parents are starving them deliberately. And then one person even made a joke like that the parent was eating the food of the child. Then there was the article from the outlet The Free Press downplaying the deaths of starving children by saying that they had pre-existing conditions. I hear what you're saying about this being an intentional kind of act of violence by the Israeli government, but then there's also this narrative that is being used to justify the starvation. Who's driving the narrative?
I watch, I can't quite watch Channel 14, I admit, because Channel 14 is particularly odious. Yeah. But I do watch...
It's a hardcore right-wing government backing, almost echoing news station.
Yeah, I mean, it's called in Israel the Fox of Israel, but it's probably much right. worse than that.
It is, yeah. But
I watch the sort of more mainstream TV news every day. First of all, you have to understand that in Israel, what people see and what people hear is completely different. People live in a bubble. Now, they can come out of that bubble if they want to, but they usually don't choose to. So in Israel, when you talk about starvation, what you're saying is Hamas has succeeded in its hunger propaganda. Why is Israeli propaganda failing? Why is the Hasbara failing? Although we showed all those pictures showing that these were kids who had pre-existing conditions, still the world believes the Hamas propaganda. Hamas are much better at that than us. That's the way people understand it in Israel. Now, of course, there are people...
I'm sorry, I have to ask you about that. Is that because they actually don't believe that starvation is happening and they just are buying into the idea that it's all a Hamas production? Or... are they indifferent to the starvation and they just want to beat Hamas in the messaging game?
Both and another one. They're not just indifferent. So that's one of the interesting things in Israel right now. If you look at opinion polls, most people want the war, as they call it, to end. They want to get rid of this government. They want to return the hostages. And most people would like to see Gaza ethnically cleansed. So... people are not only indifferent to it and not only buying to Israeli propaganda, they also, in a sense, are bloody-minded. They actually want this to happen.
In your view, given this growing discontent with Israel globally, what is the future of Israel?
Look, I mean, my position has been, I care about Israel. I'm an Israeli citizen. I have friends and family there. As you said, I mean, I served in the army. I care about it. I think that this government and the impunity with which Israel has been able to act now for almost 2 years are digging the grave of that society. They're ruining that society. So if anybody cares about Israel, quite apart from the horror that is being visited on Palestinians, if anybody cares about that state, you have to change the entire political paradigm, and you cannot do it through bombs. Mm. And you cannot do it now simply by persuasion. You have to do it by forcing the state of Israel to accept the limits of its power. And the limits of its power are set by its allies, especially the United States. As long as they don't do that, they're helping this government, which is anti-democratic, which is messianic, which is Jewish supremacist, and ultimately, as we see, genocidal, to drive this country into a hole. And it will be very hard for it then to get out of it.
Omer Bartov, thank you so much for joining us on Upfront.
Thank you.